Okay. Hey. Hi. Hello. Today we have another episode of High Fidelity,
which is our new spinoff show where we invite former guests of Future Ecologies to conduct their own interview with whoever they want, extending our community network to cover topics and ideas that we might not otherwise have been able to.
Our guest host for today's edition is Adam Davis, who we last heard from in Season 5, Episode 6, Making a Living.
He's the co-founder of Ecosystem Investment Partners, and he's interviewing... Actually, Mendel, have we ever had anyone who worked at the White House on the show before?
Not to my knowledge. In this episode, we're hearing from Tim Mayle, former associate director at the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Obama administration, and now founder of the Environmental Policy Innovation Center, or EPIC.
That's an amazing acronym. And we just wanted to say that it's kind of strange for us to release an episode about topical politics. It's not usually what you come to us for, which is why we wanted to give you a heads up that this interview was recorded all the way back a lifetime ago on January 30th of 2025, in just the first few weeks of the second Trump term.
But despite not having our current view of history or of this administration and its relationship to both laws and norms, we think this interview's core questions about nonpartisan environmental policy remain evergreen. Let's go.
Let's go.
Fidelity. Well, hello, Tim. How nice to see you.
You too, Adam. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Our guest today is Tim Mayle, the head of the Environmental Policy Innovation Center in Washington, D.C. And it's so nice to have a chance to talk to you on this podcast. I met Tim some 20 years ago when he was a senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund. And after 11 years or so with nonprofit organizations like Environmental Defense, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and Defenders of Wildlife, Tim joined the Obama administration and the Council for Environmental Quality at the White House, and actually was an associate director there at the White House. So the first question I wanted to start with, Tim, is what was it like going from a nonprofit to the White House? Was it like being on the TV show The West Wing?
I wish it were. The reality of being in a nonprofit is that you have no power and you're trying to convince the people that you think have all the power to do the thing you want them to do. And then when you get there, you realize how many barriers still exist between you now being on the inside and being able to get something done that seemingly the president, the people want you to do. So it's always, I think it's always impressive how elusive change is for, regardless of what seat you're in. But the reality was that the really exciting thing was that it was, still so much closer. There was so much more I could get done in an average day from within the White House Council than I could, from the outside.
It must have been exciting and maybe a little intimidating, your first day in the White House, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big place and there's a lot of people that work there, a few thousand at the end of the day across all the councils and support offices. But yeah, it is initially, pretty intimidating and exciting. And, there's a difference. I came in the second term of President Obama's time in office. And so, more of a second term is kind of heads down, more people who are experienced at that point and good at getting stuff done. So I think it's probably easier as well to jump in at that point because there's just more process and more efficiency about how things are operating.
Is there any particular accomplishment or, something you accomplished there that you'd want to highlight to sort of summarize your time there?
Yeah, I mean, the highlight for me kind of personally was working on executive orders or similar executive actions with a team of people, of course, put in place a new executive order on invasive species. President Clinton had put in place the first executive order. And, we had learned a lot in the intervening, decade and a half. And so, that executive order is one example. really appreciated the chance I had to work with you on a second executive action around mitigation and private investment in nature, which was completely new in a federal, you know, policymaking space. So that was a really exciting thing to work on. And I still reflect back on that all the time, despite the fact that President Trump rescinded it. So it doesn't exist as policy anymore. And then, I mean, the reality is when I was done there, when I had a kind of a closeout period in the last days I was there during the Trump administration, I had time to, you know, count up all the meetings I had had. And my estimate was something like 3,700 meetings in, you know, in 2.5 years. And so what that means is there's a lot of little things. There's a lot, not little to the people involved, but, you know, things that come up once and then you move on. And so there were some really meaningful things that felt like I was able to do, you know, kind of helping one set of Americans, you know, get some question answered or move something forward. I mean, just almost constituent work that I'm still really proud of. Sometimes that's just connecting, you know, somebody to someone at an agency like USDA to be able to get their question heard and responded to.
No, that's fabulous. And we'll, you know, given what's going on this week, we'll talk some more about executive orders in a little bit. But I did want to ask you, after your stint in the White House, you decided to start a new environmental nonprofit, as I said, the Environmental Policy Innovation Center. And I guess a question would be that there are already so many environmental nonprofits. So why did you feel the need to start something new instead of working to make one of the existing organizations better?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a right answer at the end of the day, but I had realized a couple of things in my career. One, I took a personality test that showed in the organization I was at the time that I was extremely risk tolerant and everybody around me was extremely risk averse, which immediately isolated me at that place where I worked. But it made me realize that I wanted to go somewhere where I could be in good company in being risk tolerant. The second was being at CEQ, where you just referenced, I realized that I loved having dozens of things show up on my plate every day. I have a short and long attention span. I like the mental gymnastics that come from, you know, jumping from one subject to the other and while still holding on to them in the long term. So I was trying to build a place that would, an environmental organization that was really comfortable talking about changing policy, changing procedures, changing culture in ways that would embrace risk in pursuit of, you know, much faster planetary progress. The way we frame it is the planet's on fire and, you know, now is not the time to have one more meeting. We'd really like to be able to, you know, see a lot more execution, a lot more experimentation, a lot more scaling of everything. And I still to this day have not found another nonprofit that's quite as willing to embrace that while pursuing environmental improvement and public health improvement.
Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of EPIC. And I love your concise sort of tagline for the organization. I'll read it. It's, we build policies that deliver spectacular improvements in the speed of environmental progress. It is different than what you hear from a lot of other organizations, and it captures a sense of urgency that I know a lot of people feel. But I guess the question is, it seems like that felt need for change is intense, not only for those worried about climate change and water quality and biodiversity and so on, but also for those who are just trying to do business, who are trying to provide ordinary products and services and need to negotiate or navigate an intensely complicated system in order to get environmental permits. And it seems like the system isn't working well for either group, right? The ones who are trying to protect the natural world more, or who are trying to get things done. And let's just say that they were trying to get things done in a responsible way. It's not working for them either. So where does EPIC fit into all of that?
Our team is about 40 people. So, you know, there's a limited bandwidth of what we can work on. We have to be nimble and targeted in our work. So, you know, we're conscious of that. You know, we look for opportunities to get involved in something where we feel like we can kind of punch above our weight or moneyball the work so that we have a bigger outcome compared to the effort we put in. We're sitting in a space, maybe it's kind of an uncomfortable middle space, where we are simultaneously trying to help those people that you describe get permission from government to do whatever the thing is that they want to do. Build a school, build a road, advance new infrastructure, you know, make something work with technology. And the people who are trying to improve the environment, people like yourself, you know, deeply involved in a massive effort to expand restoration across the country. And the people who traditionally think about protecting, you know, things like holding on to what we have. We're simultaneously working with all those folks. We work really closely with government in an ideal form. We're able to really collaborate to facilitate a conversation among people in government. I often find people talk about silos. I think silos are kind of a natural part of human society. They're not just a governmental problem. And they function much of the time. It's actually good to be in a silo because you can get a bunch of work done that is appropriately in front of you. But then it becomes hard to work with others. And I find that we can often help put people together who are natural allies for a period of time to allow them to collaborate. So it's a mix of, like, you know, working with industry, working with folks in government. We spend a lot of time, and this was came from my experience in the White House. We spend a lot of time trying to find people who are sitting in a chair that gives them a lot of power. We know that they want to do something specific, but they don't know how to do it and they don't have the team to do it. And so if we can find somebody like that, somebody basically with a rock on top of a hill, as opposed to a rock at the bottom of a hill, and they just need help figuring out which way to roll it, that's where we want to get in. We want to help them roll the rock down the right side of the hill. So that's what we're looking for all the time in our work, is somebody who really is already enabled, and they need a team. They need help. They need ideas.
I guess the question goes to the balancing act, right? Between protecting everything and not protecting anything.
Yeah.
Right. From a conservation standpoint, we've done a lot of conservation in the US. It's not like we lack for national parks or protected areas, but by the same token, the pace of change is still relentless, and the facts are the facts with regard to the climate and biodiversity and water quality and so on, right? So it's a real tension.
It is. I mean, I just don't think there's a future, a near-term future for humanity where we're truly not damaging anything as we, you know, add 2 billion people to the planet and update our infrastructure and improve millions or billions of people's quality of life, right? There's just not a way to do that without using more water or land, places that nature depends on. So there's trade-offs. There's always going to be trade-offs. And even if there was no growth, right? Like, people move. People go from New York to Florida too often, in many people's view. And so you have to deal with just the change that happens all the time in society to make room for that. So there are trade-offs, and that's where, you know, those trade-offs aren't usually a scientific question. That's really a limitation. That's where a lot of the risk aversion comes from. People are waiting for evidence to just give them the answer, right? It literally shows the answer, like a DNA test for a murder scene, right? Like, aha, there it is. That's all the evidence we need, right? Like, it just doesn't exist all that often in conservation decision-making or land use decision-making. There's trade-offs and deciding how much of one thing and how much of something else, how much damage we're going to allow to occur, and how much compensatory or offsetting action we're going to require, and what types, is a subjective decision at some point. And I think where we try to insert ourselves, what we think there could be a lot more of, is a less subjective process to get to the point at which decisions can be made. So there's still a set of judgment calls that have to be made, but the steps to get there could be much, much faster and much, much clearer, more predictable for anybody. I mean, part of what we're talking about for context is, you know, let's say somebody wants to build a new road or add 2 lanes to a highway, right? They should be able to, that state highway agency should be able to hire somebody who works for the Federal Wildlife Agency. And that person should mostly be able to tell them exactly what the wildlife agency needs to make a decision. And too often what they find is they hire that person with deep experience and they put all the material together and they get to the end point and it's wrong, right? They put together the wrong information. They have to go back and do something else for a year. That's what shouldn't, we find a lot of the friction in our systems are because that doesn't work predictably, right? If you need to be able to get a decision, ideally a decision happens faster. it's a major tension point in our democracy of like whether it works for us is, can you actually get decisions? But it should also be as a profession, right? If environmentalism is a profession, you should be able to tell people these are the steps you take to get things to move along. And that should be true most of the time. So I feel like we constantly have to work at that and find ways to do it better.
Yeah, yeah. It's a perfect segue to my next set of questions, really about balance and trade-offs. And going back to the notion of the executive orders, we're recording this in the second week of the new Trump administration, V2. And I guess not surprisingly, there's a lot of focus on the executive orders that President Trump is issuing every day right now. And the level of disruption is pretty dramatic from the norms and mores that have defined how the federal government works, at least how it worked in the past. And for a lot of listeners, I think it's very hard to distinguish between rhetoric and reality, like all the things that are being said versus what it really means for environmental protection, among many issues, of course. But since we're talking about that, what is an executive order? And how does it relate to sort of the reality, not just the rhetoric of environmental protection?
Right. So, I mean, there's three branches of government. There's all these laws that we have, quite a lot of them, and, you know, regulations that back them up, that implement those laws. There's a lot of gray space, though. And so executive orders are a very appropriate way for the president to basically say, these are my priorities. And within the limits of the laws, within the gray space, this is how I want you to implement all those laws consistent with my direction. Somebody like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, president during World War II, he issued something like 1,000 executive orders. I can't remember the number exactly, but it must have been like one a day. So he really set a high point that nobody has yet come close to. But all executive orders at their end basically say nothing in here supersedes existing law, right? Like you have to implement this within the limits of the law, and that's what they're for. That's really what they're for, and it's really appropriate, I think, in a kind of a governance sense. I wish that all cabinet secretaries did secretarial orders and all presidents did executive orders on day one, just like we're seeing now, because it's a statement of priorities on paper that people can react to, as opposed to some, statement in the newspaper. It's really direction to the staff of the president, which is what the whole executive branch is, on how to implement something. I'm obviously shocked by some of the actions we're seeing right now, but because they perhaps go beyond what's legal. But that's an appropriate thing for a president to do. I think that's a great way for executive leadership to happen.
But it does seem, though, that even very experienced news organizations like the New York Times cover executive orders as if they were sort of more than just guidance for their staff. Like they are sort of accomplished facts in some sense. They're changing things. And that's what I'm trying to tease out, is like, if it's just direction to the staff, then they don't change laws, they don't change regulations, they don't change appropriations. So how seriously should people take them? How seriously should people take all these executive orders, again, with regard to the idea of environmental protection?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'll say is the attention on the environment in executive orders is pretty unusual, right? It's not very usual for permitting to get any attention whatsoever. Clean Air Act, National Environmental Policy Act, Endangered Species Act, that doesn't usually happen in the first week, let alone on the first day. So people should take that seriously. It's a sign of the priority that this administration is placing on dramatically changing those laws in ways that fit other goals like energy dominance. So that's new. And, because executive orders must be consistent with law as a norm that depends upon the other branches of government, Congress and the judicial branch, maintaining a balance, right? People also look appropriately as executive orders to say, what are the other branches of government doing? And if the other branches of government are saying, looks fine to us, you know, it's a signal that, that the limits we thought might have been in law are different, right? And I think, let me back up a little bit more and kind of reframe this a bit. Some of the language in those executive orders around permitting basically says things that associated with energy, unless it's wind energy or solar, on which most of the orders are silent, but all other forms of energy, i.e. mostly fossil fuel-based energy, should not have any permitting obstacles in their way. So there's specific directions to multiple agencies to clear away those obstacles. I mean, those laws fundamentally say you need a permit. So, you know, how do you reconcile clear away all obstacles with the law says you need a permit, right? There's a tension there. And there's also the language that each president uses to express themselves. So, you know, you could find a balance, right? Okay, we're really supposed to find ways to make there be dramatically fewer obstacles. You know, we work at one, this is a funding program rather than a permitting program, but one of the funding programs we work with that EPA has 75 steps in order to go from asking for money to receiving the money. 75 is a lot of steps. I would call that 75 obstacles. If I as an agency could find a way to eliminate 30 obstacles in that process, I would feel pretty good about it. It's not all obstacles, but it's a lot of obstacles, right? Like, and can I do that consistent with the law? Maybe. I would try really, really hard because the president told me to. That's, I think, the way I'd interpret direction like this if I were, you know, trying to think about a reasonable way to build on what's been identified as a priority. The other part of this is that, like, those obstacles actually aren't just obstacles, right? If you're trying to put a pipeline through rural Nebraska and get an eminent domain, a bunch of corn farmers' lands, those corn farmers might raise their hands and say they have concerns about that. So they're an obstacle, but they're also a community that has reasonable interests in what their community looks like and, in fact, how their land is used. So another way to think about that is that's not an obstacle at all. That's a constituent that we're supposed to be finding a way to serve and balance associated with serving other constituencies and other needs of the country. And so what I'm worried that they're clearing away is the ability for people to raise their hands and say, hey, this is going to affect something that I care about. There's probably a smarter way to do this, or there's a way to do this that leaves me something closer to whole. And at the end of the day, that's what permitting is meant to be about, right? Like better ways to do projects just to avoid dumb mistakes or the absence of best practices or state-of-the-art learning, and the ability of diverse people to raise their hands in a process and say, you know what, this actually affects me and I have something to say about it. That's at the end of the day what I think is kind of being missed in this conversation.
But your fundamental point is that more needs to be revealed about how the legislative and judicial branches are going to react to these orders from the executive. So Trump is saying, these are my priorities. And there was a lot of pushback on this freeze on spending. Apparently, Trump rescinded that freeze today after the courts had stayed it anyways. But that kind of tug back and forth is of, you know, an example of what you're talking about with regards to the balance of powers. I went back and looked at James Madison's writing this morning about the balance of powers and what some of the discussions of the founders were about the reason why they structured various things the way they did. It seems like a really opportune time to go back and read some of that stuff. But beyond that balance, beyond the executive orders, it's still clear that environmental protection in any conventional sense is going to be a low priority for the for this current government, certainly behind energy dominance and increasing the pace of development. I mean, that much is clear. You know, articles like one this morning that talked about the so-called God Squad that can override the Endangered Species Act and literally allow species to go extinct if it, again, is an obstacle to development. It sounds like a complicated process to do that, no matter what the executive order is, but nonetheless, that kind of thing. And so I guess what I want to ask is, how much of the frustration with environmental permitting processes and just bureaucratic log jams in general, not just in the environmental issue, space, but you know, since we're talking about environment, how much do you think the frustration with those things led to the backlash that led to Trump getting into office in the first place? Or certainly the buildup of frustration with the process to the point where people really were willing to just say, we need to get rid of the process. In other words, are Democrats and environmental groups that have resisted any changes to environmental laws at least partly responsible for backlash?
First off, I think this had a minor effect. This specific issue of environmental laws had a very minor effect on the election outcome. I mean, the reality is that, you know, just to use one example, let me back up. There's something like 2 million permitting decisions that happen in a single presidential term every time. 2 million. That's a lot of processes. That's a lot of steps. Now, those aren't all formal permits where there's a signed document that says, here's your permit. But for the public's perspective, they look like permits. There's paperwork, there's steps, there's approvals. You have to wait X days. Those are 2,500,000 a year of activities, right? Now, the vast majority of those are trivial. The public never hears about them. They're not asked their permission. They really involve the agencies, you know, going back and forth on something. So let's say you're installing an underground power line in South Dakota. It's above the ground. There's a windstorm or an ice storm in the winter. Power lines come down. They decide to underground that power line. When that power line is put underground, you're going to dig a hole to put it in, maybe through a bunch of wheat fields in the Dakotas. Well, you might disturb a historic relic. So you have to go through a process which triggers the National Historic Preservation Act, which triggers a state level process, and also then triggers the National Environmental Policy Act to figure out whether you need a minor permit. It's called the categorical exclusion. Every time, every mile you build separately, every 30 miles you build triggers a much bigger process, right? 500,000 times a year. So I think I'm imagining that permitting is one piece. Lots of other things like procurement, you know, are a second piece, right? So using the example of the rescinded document you mentioned, a state like Ohio gets $30 billion of federal funding a year from the federal government. So it's no surprise they were a little upset when Washington said, you all in Ohio are not getting most of that money. That's $750 million a day, right? So even pausing it for a day, I mean, that's going to slow down the money. I mean, a week, a month, it is literally like a government shutdown, except the people you're shutting down don't work for the government. They're all the people that depend on the government. So there's all these decisions, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of decisions. And I think if people are frustrated, it's that those little decisions are so difficult. I don't think people are necessarily so surprised that it takes a while to do something big, like build a massive pipeline or a new nuclear reactor. It's the little things that, you know, can create enormous friction in the process. So that's what we focus is. It's a lot of like the all the small things really matter. And those things, initially, when a lot of these laws passed, the small things would have just been ignored. Most people didn't even think about them. Like a wetland restoration. Nobody would have thought, well, we should go through a permitting process to make sure the wetland restoration isn't damaging the environment. Nobody would have thought that in 1979. Just wouldn't have even been a conversation, right? Like, but now it is. And it takes a really long time to get a wetland restoration approved under these laws designed to slow down harmful projects. And that kind of thing goes on and on and on. So if I think about where this intersects with the election, you know, that it's the small processes. On big stuff, I mean, the Obama administration shortened the time it takes to get a National Environmental Policy Act permit through an environmental impact statement. The Trump administration, the first Trump administration, came in and bettered that time by like a year. They shortened the timeline for the average environmental impact statement by like a year. The Biden administration came in and cut basically another year off the timeline. So it's about 2.5 years now to get an environmental impact statement done for a really, really big project. That's really not that long at the end of the day. Like, we're kind of fixing that. And what I see in this administration is basically a behind the times reflection of saying, you know, those things are a really big problem, when in fact, the problems are kind of being worked out for the really big projects. It's all these small projects and small processes that to me are a much bigger source of frustration.
So, yeah, I guess the line of questioning there was about the extent to which pragmatic solutions or pragmatic improvements like the ones you're discussing could actually sway voters, to understand the environmental agenda as reasonable and actionable as opposed to just being a big impediment, right? But the other, the bigger problem seems to me that that environmental issues have become purely ideological. It's like a code for being on the Republican team or the Democratic team, regardless of the specifics of, reality. So climate change, if you're concerned with climate change, you're on the Democratic team. And if you say that it's a hoax, you're on the Republican team. And those aren't sort of helpful positions either way. So I guess I'm trying to tease out here your thoughts about how much pragmatic improvements can actually change the politics.
Yeah, I hold on to the fact that it wasn't that long ago that the Bush administration really cared about the environment and had a whole agenda, a very proactive agenda around cooperative and collaborative conservation. And that's not that many presidents ago that we still had a bipartisan consensus, and we can find a way to get back there, again. On this issue of permitting, and I'm really curious about, your thoughts on it as well, but I've been working on permitting in Washington for as long as I've known you. I can't believe it's close to 20 years. And mostly people weren't very interested. I mean, for me, the political cycle was that Democrats used to think everything was fine and they didn't really want to talk about making changes. They just wanted to defend the status quo. Republicans said nothing was fine. It was all broken and pointless. And at some level, right, at the extreme level. And what's changed, I would date it really since the second Obama administration, the realization that shovel ready was pretty difficult to deliver on because of permitting rules, that the first version of the effort from the Democratic side of the aisle was, okay, we're just going to put a lot more effort into this. We're going to really kind of muscle up our capacity because these we believe these processes work. They've just been underinvested. And I think the Biden administration basically did a version of that too. And more recently in Congress, at the edges, what you're seeing are Democratic proposals to say, no, there's a set of projects that we really don't want these laws to apply to. The laws actually don't, the processes don't work for us either, but we want them to be waived for kinds of projects that we like, climate smart projects. So for the first time, you now have one set of people saying, make those people deal with the laws we don't want to for our priorities versus the other. And you definitely see this at the state level, right? So in your state of California, Governor Newsom, Governor Brown before him as well, have waived state environmental laws from applying to a number of things, like most recently the wildfire recovery, the tragic wildfire that occurred in Los Angeles. So, that kind of alternative, right? Like there's no way to make this work. We're just going to eliminate it is kind of a sad state to be in. And for us, for me, at least, I worked on permitting for 20 years. There's finally this moment to say, like, is there actually a version of allowing people to work together to choose a better design for stuff and to make sure people affected by it get to know about it, get to kind of raise their hands. Like there's finally an opportunity identifying those approaches, fast, simpler approaches that aren't so much about paperwork and are more about engagement, finally have a moment. And I'm hoping that what comes from this is like the ability to actually make some of those things happen in law.
Yeah, you know how I feel about it, Tim. I mean, using science to measure impacts and then have verifiable offsets that make up for those impacts isn't perfect, but it's better than having to get rid of the law altogether if you need to get something done. And it is dramatic that even Democrats are saying, we can't operate, we can't get renewable energy or housing done within the constraints of the laws that we otherwise defend. That's not a good place to be. So the notion of compensatory mitigation, of avoiding, then minimizing, but then mitigating, right? That's the hierarchy in law. And if you believe that that's a better alternative than just saying no or fighting to the death over every over every single permitting issue, then you got to figure out a way for that mitigation system to work. So you're not just waiving laws the way even Democrats have had to do here in California. But I want to step back from the rough and tumble of politics a bit for some sort of broader philosophical questions, if you will, to make this a more interesting interview than just talking about the current events. And I want to get your reaction to the idea that scientific facts are in some way impervious to lies, right? So the health of the ocean, the status of biodiversity, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, sort of, they are what they are. And you can say what you want about them. In other words, someone can say that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is going down, but it's actually going up. And it's going up at 10 parts per million every 4 years. And so in a way, it doesn't matter. All these politics don't matter to the ocean and to the atmosphere, right? That's just human chatter in the human world. And at some point, the reality is just going to rise up anyways. We're going to be affected by the reality anyway. And so I just want to get your reaction to that idea that the facts are impervious to the lies in some way.
Yeah, that's still the world I live in, certainly. I mean, it's the simplest level. There's a set of facts. I mean, you gave a set of examples of them. A wetland is a wetland, right? Like these are not really arbitrary or subjective kinds of issues. And you're right. If the point is to get action to happen around them and the action doesn't happen, the fact continues on its you know, merry or tragic way toward an outcome, right? That's just happening all the time around us. I guess, but if I could, you know, argue with you a little bit, there are a number of areas that are pretty gray, right? In science. We don't know what a species is or a subspecies or a distinct population in a very absolute way. Even if we did know precisely how many species there were on the planet and under that construct, right? That's a construct, a human construct to categorize things, to classify things. We still wouldn't know where the boundaries were on what's important. You know, do we save the most unique biodiversity? Do we save the most iconic biodiversity? So, you know, the science can only take us so far. And I find that's an area that where the facts become much harder to identify, I guess I'd say. I don't know, like there's a lot of populations of salmon in the Pacific Northwest in California. And there's a lot of populations of salmon in Japan and Russia and Alaska, Canada. How many populations do we need, right? Science can't really tell us that answer. They can say that the salmon in those ecosystems play a role. But if you're trying to decide whether to save a salmon in California or save a rare cave spider in Texas, there's no answer from science to that question, I feel like. So, I mean, I hear you on the top line things, but there's also a space where there's just a limit to, you know, how useful science is in decision making. I'm a scientist, of course, so I'm kicking myself. I'm like, I shouldn't be like diminishing my specialty, but it's true.
I guess what I'm trying to explore is I wake up every morning and think about environmental issues. And I have for, you know, 40 years or something. And I know you do the same. And so for me, it's a tremendously important set of issues and issues in some sense that take precedence over other human and societal issues, because I think they're so fundamental to our well-being. And not just our well-being, but the well-being of life. And I really believe in all that, right? So that's why I start with the question about whether facts are impervious to lies. But it's not just lies, it's really ideology too, right? And there's ideology on both sides. It seems like in the environmental community, the word crisis is used for everything, for all the issues. There's a crisis. But despite the terrible events like the LA fires that just happened or Hurricane Milton last year, it seems that for most people, most days, really, it doesn't feel like a crisis. It's just hot or cold or windy or it's raining. But it's not really a crisis. And so you have sort of two sides. You have people wanting to minimize or diminish or just ignore environmental problems. And then you have other people trying to build them up because they feel passionately that they should take precedence. And so in all that, I guess the question, if there is one, you know, what would it take for environmental issues to actually be a higher priority than they are? To take precedence over the other things that capture our attention? How would we actually get that to happen?
Yeah, I guess I'd reframe it a little bit and say, I think we don't often present people, we try to convince people that there's a crisis as opposed to just presenting them with a solution. And it's actually a solution that they can, you know, live with, right? So if you give someone, if you say, I mean, I love electric cars, I really do. And at the end of the day, if you're telling somebody, here's something that goes faster and you can charge it at your house, you don't have to stop at the gas station on your way to work or on your family vacation. It's got fewer parts to maintain, so you're going to be in the shop less. That's what they need to know. They don't need to know that they're contributing to a climate solution, right? And I think we often have made it about ideology. We environmentalists have made it about ideology and making it about you need to make a choice of whether you're for or against the planet. And a lot of people are willing to say, I'm not for the, I've got other things to do, right? Like they may not be literally checking the box saying I'm against this. They're just not participating because you've made it about changing their lives, them making a conscious choice to change their lives instead of just an obvious choice to change their lives. That's the way I think about it. And we spend a lot of time basically trying to get people to agree that we're right first, as opposed to just giving them an option of what to do with in their own, you know, space of action. I think most people at the end of the day, if you ask, do you want to be able to drink your tap water? Most people would say, yes, I do. Right. What does it take to do that? Is my bill going to be, you know, reasonably similar to what it is today? Absolutely. Like, make sure it's not too expensive and make sure I always have tap water and a shower. And there's a bunch, you're telling me a bunch of things associated with nature are behind that. Okay, no problem. Go protect that watershed around that reservoir, whatever you need, but I want to make sure I have water. And I don't think we frame the questions that way. We frame the questions that invite an ideological response. And I think, you know, there's two studies. One came out a couple of years ago that showed that homes, this was done in my state of Maryland, homes within a certain distance of a stream restoration saw a 10% increase in property values. And there was a more recent study this year that came out and looked at critical habitat designations and found that the critical habitat actually contributed to a very small positive change in house prices, including houses near the critical habitat. And in both cases, the surmise of the scientists behind this work is that people are identifying running water, recreational space, tree cover, the cooling benefits that those trees provide, the bird life, the views, the vistas, the scenery, has a bunch of amenities that have direct benefit to people that they're willing to pay for, right? Like, we don't ask questions about those kinds of things. Would you rather have a park near you or no parks near you, right? We're just framing it all wrong. We're framing it to force people to say, is climate more important than schools? That's the way we're framing it. And I just think that's the wrong frame. And we've been doing that for way too long.
That's great. Your points about Maryland remind me to tell people that you were actually on your local city council in Tacoma Park in Maryland and served there for 5 years when you were elected back in 2011. And in particular, I wanted to ask you about the measure you worked on to allow America's first 16-year-old voting age. That's a pretty interesting measure. So I want to know what happened to it. Did it take effect? Did it not take effect? Is it being replicated elsewhere? And if not, why not?
Yes, yes, and yes. It's great. It was, we were the first place to let 16-year-olds in the United States vote. There have been more than a dozen communities around the country that have passed similar efforts. There's actually more than a dozen just in Massachusetts. But because the state legislature hasn't approved it, the local action hasn't taken effect. But in the city of Tacoma Park, the key thing is that it turns out 16 and 17 year olds are really good voters. So, you know, 20 year olds nationally, this is true, election after election, 75% or more of them don't show up in national elections. I haven't seen the data yet from the Trump-Biden election, but I assume it's similar. Most of them don't seem to care that we have President Trump in office, not enough to be bothered to vote. So 20 to 30-year-olds, really bad. 16 and 17-year-olds vote like 70-year-olds. Like, they show up. This is a community they grew up in. They have opinions. Someone is asking them their opinions. They show up like 70-year-olds at the polling station. And I haven't seen data on this in the United States, but overseas, there's a number of countries that have allowed 16-year-olds to vote for a long time, and the sky hasn't fallen. But when Austria put this policy in place, the data that they collected showed that if you let people vote at 16, they're a little more likely to keep voting at 18, 19, and 20. Like, they stick around a little bit longer because they've just been trained effectively in what voting involves. So I hope that's the case. But for me, I just love the idea of, you know, younger people voting. And one of the things you hear from conservatives is they're just trying to, you know, pack the vote, right, with their supporters. Like, there's a lot of conservative youth. I mean, anybody who's had a teenager knows that they do not just decide to agree with their parents, right? Like, they're adults. They have independent thoughts. And I love the dialogue it's created about, you know, making sure that the needs of the next generation are captured in what our government does. And I think bringing them into the voting population is the best way to do that.
Do you think they vote at higher levels because it's so novel? That they've been, you know, sort of given a special kind of permission that other people don't get?
I mean, it could be. We're five elections in my city now, and they keep showing up at the same level. So the novelty, I mean, it's still new for each of the individuals, but it's also new for an 18-year-old to vote, right? And they don't seem to care. So if it were just, hey, this is my first time, like going to drink, you know, when you hit the drinking age, right? Like on your 21st birthday. That doesn't seem to appeal to 18-year-olds, but it sure does to 16-year-olds. And I think because it's stuck around, I think there's and it's really about, you know, home and connecting back to the beginning of our conversation. You know, people really care about the place that they live in and that they are deeply connected to. And so a 16-year-old is probably in a place where they went to school, where their home is, where their friends are, where they had their first kiss, where they played on the playgrounds. And so they have a really deep connection to it. And I think that's much more likely at 16 than it is at 24. So I would encourage the country to pass a change like this in a heartbeat anywhere else, because it's just a great thing to see.
Yeah, thank you. That's fascinating. I guess one of the things I think about more now that I'm sort of reaching the end of my own career is this whole notion of succession and, you know, the next generations and what we're leaving them. And I guess I'm curious what you would say to someone just graduating from high school or graduated from college and starting to look for a job, trying to make a living, doing something they care about, given the level of disruption and change and challenge that's happening right now, how they can hope to contribute and make a difference. What would you say to someone like that?
Yeah, I'd say two things. The first is that the whole idea of generations, Gen X, millennial, Gen Y, Gen Z, is a construct. And I think it's often a construct used to isolate us from one another. There's a lot more that unifies you, somebody who cares deeply about the environment, and some 18-year-old who also cares about the environment. And there's this construct, though, that we use to say, actually, Adam, you don't matter. People your age don't matter. You don't care about the environment. We have nothing in common. People my age all matter. And I, as far as I can tell, there's just as many enemies or opponents of environmental action in every generation, and apathy more than anything else. So you're a natural ally for somebody who's 18 or 20, but generations are used to isolate them. So that's the first thing I'd say, is stop pretending that the children are the future. The future is actually sprinkled throughout every generation. And if we work together more often, things would be a lot better than if we pretended it was only the people, you know, your age, my age, whatever the age is.
I love it. The future is sprinkled out through the sprinkled through the generations. It's great.
The other thing I'd say from more of a career advice perspective is AI is really thrilling to have at one's fingertips. The things that a 24-year-old can do, can contribute at this point in a white-collar job in my field of environmental policy, are almost completely replaceable by what AI can do. That said, within 3 years, like 3 years into their jobs, AI becomes absolutely a tool, a third arm, a fourth arm for a 28-year-old, a 29-year-old with a little bit of experience before them. So the thing I'd say is, if you're going to get a degree in the environment, also make sure you have experience in coding and programming and project management around technology, and figure out how you grow your skill set and your tools as fast as possible around, you know, insight, innovation, novelty, putting very complicated things together in a way that quickly makes you an asset, you know, within a few years makes you an asset that machines cannot currently compete with, and where you are the tool user of AI, because that is where the future is going. Every PDF I get, I am uploading and having machines read for me before I read them myself. I mean, it's an instant Cliff Notes dummy's guide to whatever it is. It is fantastically useful. And the first versions, and I expect you know this too, you've told me about some of this, the first versions of things that AI is able to produce now are almost always going to be better than what a college graduate can produce on their first day on the job. And that said, right, that's okay. It's not meant to diminish the recent college graduate. It's just that their period of then generating value, they have to think about that as the key thing of those 3 years or 4 years as being the key window to become value generating as fast as possible.
So those are pretty practical suggestions. I definitely appreciate them. But I guess I'm curious also, like, more maybe emotionally, about sort of how to stay upbeat enough, you know, positive enough, focused, you know, sharp, and not get discouraged. So I'm curious what you'd say to younger people in the face of not just the politics, but, you know, the difficult facts of climate change and sort of the intractable nature of some of these challenges. It's not like fossil fuel use was going down during the Biden administration. It may be more front and center for the new Trump administration, but the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere went up and up in the last Democratic administrations as well. So it's discouraging and it's certainly challenging. So how do you personally stay focused and sharp? And, you know, sort of keep fighting for what you believe.
Yeah, I don't know what my parents did wrong when they were making me, but I am just a resilient optimist. And I can't help it. I mean, I feel like I live in such a fantastic world and that it's just getting better all the time. And I know the climate piece is deeply frustrating to people, how hard it is to get us to the peak, you know, peak damage, basically. But you know, reflecting on your field, right? Like, we live in this world where there are so many people who are extremely good and experienced at fixing nature and allowing nature to come back in a beautiful form that looks like it once looked, or better maybe in some ways, not always, in some ways, you know, putting 75% of biodiversity back in a wetland that was temporarily a field. I mean, we are really freaking good at that. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to see. And if I think about the next century, especially in a place like America, where our population growth, our kind of per capita resource consumption has somewhat plateaued, rebuilding a natural space for nature and for us is right there as something that's going to happen. Versus if you were in the 1970s, you'd be looking at burning rivers. I mean, every river burning, right? Or dead, one of the two. It may not be burning, but it doesn't have any fish in it. So I look at that. I think about, you know, my brother telling me about the once super fun site river in my hometown that now has striped bass in it. It's just incredible, the stuff that the resilience of the planet, I guess I'd say. And, you know, while I can be disappointed that we're not making progress on climate change faster, I see that sunrise really clearly for me in so many ways. And, you know, this feels like in the United States, this feels like a silly kind of comma, like going back to fossil fuels, it's just not happening. It's just not. I just feel like it's a dumb moment that we're in, but the future is just not there. And it's in this kind of work that you do, Adam, and we get to work on the policy of.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave off our conversation, Tim. I really thank you for your time. I really thank Future Ecologies for the platform and the opportunity to have a discussion on this new High Fidelity podcast. But before we go, I just wanted to ask you if there's anything I've left out or that you'd like to talk about while we have the chance.
Yeah, I guess I would just say, I think the most underrated part of all this work is fellowship and brotherhood. It's finding a set of people that want to go in the direction you're going and getting a chance to work with them. And that's true in any field for me at the end of the day. I mean, I'm kind of an extrovert in many ways. So maybe it's just extroverts that would say that, but there is so much joy that comes from working with people where there's some fundamental alignment where you really get to collaborate. And I would, you know, I would do anything for that kind of collaboration and for the sense of having a team, you know, on the journey with me. And I think that's what makes a lot of this work great, of learning about people, of sharing their stories, of lifting up other people's work, but also being part of this. And I think there's almost nothing that we get to do now where we can do it by ourselves. I expect that's true for you. And so it's just really fun to find people who are good at complementary things that you get to do those projects with. And this field, the fields that we work in, environmental policy, environmental restoration, mitigation, corporate sustainability, I just am endlessly in awe of the people I get to meet and the fact that I get to work with them around the whole world. And I have friends that the people who I think of as like my closest professional colleagues who I've met twice in person, and everything else is Zoom and Slack and text and everything else. But man, they're doing beautiful work and it's just fun to be, you know, on the ride with them. So that's the like key thing, is this is a really personally satisfying field to be part of. I think everything I've ever heard from you suggests the same thing. And man, it's just a gift to be able to work in a career and have that sense of community and brotherhood.
Perfect. That's a perfect wrap. Fidelity.